Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Greetings, young knaves, and welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 244. The Nerdist TV show salutes time travel on BBC America this Saturday, the 18th of August, at 10, 9 central. Damon Lindelof is going to be on the show. You may remember him from a few episodes ago on the Nerdist TV show, also being an excellent guest on this podcast a couple times, and creating a bunch of stuff and writing a bunch of stuff that you probably enjoyed. So he was a fantastic guest. We also had Baratunde Thurston on. It was super, 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 super fun. So please watch the Nerdist Tribute to Time Travel this Saturday, August 18th, on BBC America. I'd like to thank this episode's sponsor, Carbonite Online Backup. Say, friend, are you a seldom sometimes or when I get around to it backer-upper? I don't know why I'm doing this voice. Maybe you think your external hard drive is all you need, but to be absolutely protected in case of anything, some sort of meltdown, someone in your hat breaks in and steals all your electronics, you need online offsite in the cloud backup from Carbonite. Because with Carbonite, your files are automatically and continually backed up, so you don't have to think about it. You can replace those emotions with anything. All that fear is gone. You can think about tater tots or what it'd be like to have a duck for a wife. I don't give a shit. It doesn't matter. You could do anything you wanted with that mental storage instead of worrying about your online storage. Oh, good riff, Hardwick. Once you have Carbonite, a computer disaster is not a disaster because your backup files are kept securely and you can just easily restore them. It's your better backup plan for home or your small business. It's Carbonite. Plans start at $59 a year. Start your free trial today at Carbonite.com. Use the offer code Nerdist and get 2 bonus months with a purchase. That's Carbonite.com. 2 bonus months with the offer code Nerdist. And now this episode, you guys. Fucking awesome. It's Dr. Demento. I mean, if I could even tell you what that guy meant to me as a kid and my comedy development and what he exposed me to and the worlds that he showed me in a whole generation and continues to do so over at his website, drdemento.com. We've had big, fancy, famous people on the podcast before, but when a guy like Dr. Demento comes on, it makes my molecules vibrate in a way that I can't. I mean, you're all fanboys of stuff, and Demento is just one of those guys for me. So this is it. We recorded at Meltdown. We recorded more podcasts there. I like it, and it was such an incredibly amazing time with him. Just hearing his voice, but seeing it come out of his mouth as opposed to just hearing it, totally flips my bean. That sounds like a euphemism for lady masturbation, and I take it back. I'm so sorry. It freaks out my clitoris head. Now, again, that's weird. It's really weird. Nerds Podcast, episode 244, with Dr. Demento.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yes.
All right.
Comedy history.
Are you recording?
It's our small satellite space here at Meltdown Comics. Let's do a quick roll call. It's a Nerdist podcast. Dr. Demento is here.
Woo, woo. Wind up your podcast.
I was just driving on Hardwick Street earlier today.
And were you like, this is a preamble of things to come?
Yes. Well, ever since we moved to that neighborhood, or at least ever since I knew about your work, I've reminded of you every time I cross that street.
That blows me away. And it still freaks me out that you are familiar with my work. You actually played a Hard and Firm song years ago.
Yeah.
And Mike Furman and I lost our minds because every Sunday night when I was growing up in Memphis, Tennessee, Dr. Demento show. I mean, it just completely... Well, we'll get into all this. There's going to be a lot of slobbering on you. Jonah Ray's here. And then our buddy Dan Pasternak.
Yeah.
Who, comedy nerd and also network suit in a weird sort of way.
Comedy nerd, then comedian.
And then comedian.
Then producer, then network suit.
Some network was like, hey, maybe we should hire a comedy nerd
to
help us program.
Are you going chronologically or in order of my capabilities?
Oh, shit. I don't know. We're going to have to tag cloud you and figure out which word is the biggest. But Dan Pasternak, for those of you guys, we did a pilot with you. Mike and I did a pilot with you at IFC. Dan is responsible for shows like Portlandia and really helping to establish IFC as kind of like alternative Comedy Central, I think.
I don't know that I want to accept the word responsible, and also I think that's very grand, but you've always been very gracious. Thank you, Chris.
Well, we've been friends a very long time.
Yeah.
You have the most insane collection of comedy albums that I've ever seen, and I think almost all of them are signed. Like Dick Gregory, Bob Newhart, Carlin, like really an extensive grouping of comedy albums.
Well, I think my collection probably pales in comparison to the guest of honor.
And
I had a little head start.
we're going to get to that. The reason, Dan, that we had you on is because you ultimately connected us all together. You've worked with Dr. D years ago when you were a kid, and Matt Myra couldn't be here, so I was like, who better to have on than someone who's known the doctor for so long?
Well, I'm very grateful.
Yeah, so it's just we. So be prepared, Dr. D, because we're about to nerd out on you, my friend.
That's what I'm here for.
So Mike Furman and I had the luxury of having a dinner with you at Largo a couple years ago at a Woodstock show.
Mm-hmm.
And the story you told was fascinating, just about like where you started. So would you mind, you know, if you don't feel like it's redundant, please give us a little background how Dr. D came to be and just kind of what the business looked like in those days.
Well, I grew up a record freak. My parents had lots of records, and the record player became my favorite toy when I was 7, 8 years old. And I'd buy all the records that I could afford. So when I discovered the Salvation Army store that had records for a nickel, this was 1953, my collection grew by leaps and bounds. I used to play disc jockey as a kid. And then by the time I was a junior in high school, I had the biggest collection of records in the school, which included a lot of then current rock and roll records. So I became the de facto disc jockey for all the sock hops at my high school. So that was my first experience playing records for an audience.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. So you DJed for your audience. You were a DJ.
Yes.
You were a high school DJ.
Right. Yeah, this was the 50s. We had one turntable. So, you know, none of this fancy stuff that they do today, of course, but had one turntable and a pile of 45s. And I'd play one, and then people just, I just had to fill the time while I hurriedly queued up the next record. Actually, I didn't cue them on. I just put the arm on the record, and you heard a little scratch, and then you heard Elvis or Bill Haley or Chuck Berry or whoever it was. So I do dedications, things like that. So this was the first speech I gave to introduce records. Then I was heavily involved in my college radio station at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, all 10 watts of it. 10-watt non-commercial station. But you never know who might be listening, you know. Anybody could be listening who just happened to be somewhere in the neighborhood of Reed College. You never knew. So, and we followed all the FCC rules very carefully, things like that. And I went from playing classical music, which the station originally, that was their format, I became the student manager and introduced a more liberal format. We still played classical, but I played the records that I found in the thrift shops of Portland, along with all other kinds of weird things.
And they let you do whatever you want.
They let me do whatever I want. You know, 10 watts.
Were you developing your on-air personality at this point? Was Dr. Demento born yet, or did your body split open and outstood Dr. Demento with the tux and the red tie and the top hat?
Dr. Demento developed gradually. The name was given to me by the obscene Stephen Kleen. That was the name he used when I was brought into the staff at KRRC, KPPC, excuse me, in Pasadena, which is where the whole concept of the Dr. Demento show took root. I was Barry Hansen, my real name, but Stephen said, oh, everybody here has a crazy name. You can't be Barry Hansen. And gradually it became Dr. Demento. That was the name that stuck.
So you took some sort of a potion, and then at night you would go out as Dr. Demento.
Yes. Now, at first, my earliest shows as Dr. Demento, the earliest shows that I have recordings of, I sounded much more studious. Of course, those were the days of laid-back FM programming. And
yeah.
the people at KPPC said, and now, Pink Floyd. And things like that. So I had a more studious, more level-headed approach, but I would tell stories about the records and about the songs and about the people who sang them. And actually, the Dr. Demento show started as a program of just rare records in general, early rock and roll records, the original records of songs that the Rolling Stones had covered.
Yeah.
So I'd play the original Muddy Waters version of something that the Stones had done. And Sly Stone was huge at that time, Sly and the Family Stone. This is 1970. But Sly had been making records for about 8 years before anybody knew who he was outside of San Francisco. So I had many of those early records. So as Sly was topping the charts with things like Dance to the Music and Everyday People, I would play his old stuff on the earliest records of his I know of. He and his brother were the Stewart Brothers, sounding like the Coasters. So
oh, wow.
I'd play those, and those were lots of fun. So I became known as this guy who was this fount of information about early rock and roll. But it was only gradually that funny music took over the show. Because I'd open the phones to requests, and I found that a large number of the requests were for novelty records, things like the Purple People Eater and the Monster Mash. And
they're coming to take me away.
They're coming to take me away. Yes. Napoleon the 14th. Yes, yeah. Indeed. So those, I found that the more of those that I played, the more popular the show got. So naturally, I became the funny music guy. I hadn't really intended to be when I started, but by the time that I moved over to station KMET, where I think Dan got to know the show, it had become pretty much the funny music show.
Wow. And this was a time in the 70s where radio ruled.
Yes.
Like and then all of a sudden that's where we started to see like shock jocks, not maybe the shock jocks, but big personalities like your Wolfman Jacks.
Oh yes.
Guys like that. And what you told Furman and I at dinner was that one of the ways that you got hired somewhere was because you just had the most records of anyone. And it was so fascinating to me that there was a time when simply having the most physical of something, particularly music, meant, well, we got to hire this guy because no one else has these records that he has.
Well, that was a big part of it, but I guess this personality that I gradually developed had to have helped some.
I realized I just underscored that part of it, so let me backpedal just a little bit and say that it was the records plus the personality at the same time.
And this wealth of knowledge. I mean, that's the thing that, that I think appealed to me is that while I was learning about Spike Jones and Alan Sherman and Stan Freberg and Tom Lehrer and all of these guys that, you know, as a 10-year-old kid I wouldn't have otherwise been exposed to, it was like, oh, I was, you know, without knowing it, getting the backstory and getting the history and getting the the influences of, you know, this person influenced this person. And if you're interested in, you know, George Carlin, then, you know, you might want to check out Lenny Bruce and all of this stuff that, you know, contextualized the recordings, you know, really is half of what got me excited, you know, in addition to the material itself.
Yeah. Well, that's what I did.
What? This is going to be a really dumb question. Really dumb question. But I think, because, you know, a lot of young people listen to the show who have just grown up with the internet. But you have this wealth of music knowledge. So where are you getting it? Where are you getting the lore? And where are you getting the stories and the back information?
It just kind of leaks in. Well, I read Billboard a lot. Mm-hmm. That was the handiest, most available source of intelligence about records that was around. I think I discovered Billboard when I was about 12. I'd go read it at the public library, and it would have the news of all the new records that came out, all kinds of music, including comedy. And so there would be lists and reviews of all the new records that were released in that given week. So I'd read about them, and I'd gradually get to know more about how the record business works. So that was one source. There weren't a whole lot of others up until, the late 70s, maybe. There weren't a whole lot of books. I mean, now there's probably 300 books about Bob Dylan alone.
Right.
But there were very few reliable books about music in those days, especially current pop music. You could read a few books about old jazz. It wasn't until 1959 that the first decent book about blues came out.
Oh, yeah.
And longer than that before there were decent books about country music. But you could read about the older jazz, a little bit about the pop music of the Gershwin or Irving Berlin era. But so I read voraciously, and I'd go to the Salvation Army, and nickel a record, I could take lots of chances, buy lots of stuff I'd never heard of, and see what it sounded like, or hear what it sounded like. And my mother, bless her, would sometimes clue me in about, this was very popular. I used to love that singer, things like that. So that helped put it in context a little bit more.
So when did you start to, what was your popularity surge? Like, when did that start to happen and you realized, oh, no, I'm actually a radio, I'm a radio personality that people know.
1973 was the year it blossomed. That's the year that I started getting really good ratings. When I started in commercial radio, I hardly knew what a rating book was.
Right.
But then the sales manager of KMET came up to me the station had done really well in one of the quarterly rating periods, and so they decided to give a party for all the jocks. They put us all on a bus and drove us to some restaurant and bar somewhere out in the edge of town, and we celebrated. And on the way, the station manager took me aside and said, "Do you realize that you have the most popular Sunday night show in all of Los Angeles?
Oh my God.
AM, FM, everything." So that put me on the map, so to speak, and that led to a demand to syndicate the show, because people figured, if it does that well in Los Angeles, it'd probably play in Peoria. So the syndication got started in the spring of 74.
Oh, wow. And at that point, it's still just rarities and not so much novel.
It had become pretty much funny music.
It was funny music.
Yeah, like I was saying, the more funny music I played, the more popular the show got. So by 73, it was probably 80-90% funny stuff.
And was it still at a time when to syndicate a radio show, they would have to press that radio show onto vinyl and then send it to that station?
Either that or reel-to-reel tapes.
Yeah.
We started with reel-to-reel tapes and then switched to vinyl. And then switch back again. It's a long and convoluted story. But finally wound up on CD, of course.
Yeah.
See, this was a point of pride for me, having grown up here in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. was that I was the beneficiary of hearing the four-hour KMET version of the Dr. Demento Show from 6 to 10 p.m. Sunday nights, and the syndicated show was only the two-hour version.
Right.
So that made me very cocky with my friends that grew up elsewhere. Because, like, you only got a funny five. I grew up with the top 10.
Yeah, that's the way it was. The syndicated show was shorter. Nobody seemed to want to take on a four-hour show, no matter how popular it was. So the two-hour show was easier to sell. And so that's why the funny five, because we didn't want quite so much of the show to be taken up with a countdown. I wanted to have more time for free form to play new stuff, things like that. So that was the difference. And there were a few records that I could get away with on KMET that I realized I probably couldn't get away with in Mobile or Salt Lake City. So there were a few.
Oh, like what?
The Smoke Off, Shel Silverstein.
Really? That was never on the syndicated show?
Not till later.
Oh, wow.
Any of any Cheech and Chong stuff or any...
Well, I had to, there's some pieces where there's like one word that might be censored for the national show, but not for the local show, things like that.
Did they bleep back then? Or was it, could you not even?
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Oh, yeah, I bleeped. I got to be a very good bleeper.
Oh, good.
Back in the days of razor blades and reel-to-reel tape.
Oh, yeah.
I got to be an expert bleeper.
Yeah, when I worked at K-Rock, it was in the 90s, and even at that point, they still had the razor blades just lying around the studio. Because even though they were on, they were still running carts.
Those were just for the coke.
Yeah, those. I think you're actually right. Especially at K-Rock in the 80s and 90s. I don't know, by the time I got there, they had mostly cleaned it up. But yeah, you would see just the razor blades all over the studio, I felt so spoiled. I'm like, what an awful way to have to edit a radio show is listen and like jump click and then splice together and then stick it like that. What a crappy process.
Well, I taught myself to edit earlier before I got to know how, before I figured out exactly how to edit a shit or a fuck.
Yeah.
I got to edit music. There was this piece called Honky Tonk by Bill Doggett that was a huge record in 1956. Honky Tonk Parts 1 and 2.
Yeah.
If you listen to the very end of Part 1, you can hear Part 2 starting. So I realized it was really just one long performance that they had cut in two.
Oh, wow.
So, when I first got my reel-to-reel recorder, one of the first things I did was to just take my record of Parts 1 and 2 and put it on tape and then edit it so that I could hear the whole six-minute performance all the way through.
Yeah. By the way, I think everyone just lost their minds to hear you drop the F-bomb.
And the S.
Oh, my God. And the S.
Fucking shit.
Yeah, fucking shit.
You know what's so funny is I actually remember, and it's so funny because it seemed like the world was getting more puritanical, and this was the indication for me that this was happening, that you used to be able to play Titties and Beer, Frank Zappa's Titties and Beer, and you used to be able to, they used to be able to say Titties and Beer, and somewhere, I think in like the late 70s or early 80s, it suddenly had to be, the titties had to be bleeped out.
That was a memo from the station manager.
He remembers.
Yeah, he had gotten complaints from somebody about it, so he decided, he didn't want to do it, but he said, he apologized and said, you're going to have to edit that. So it became cuckoos. I found a cuckoo clock sound effect, and it went, ooh, instead of.
And it was still hilarious.
Just as good.
But now, once again, since I'm on the internet, it's titties and beer again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tend to reserve the F-bombs for the end of the show, the last set of the show, in deference to people who listen with their families. But internet radio, I don't have to worry so much about that anymore.
Well, that's kind of nice, like not having to be censored. But I guess I came along to the show in the early 80s. Maybe 81, 82 is when I started listening. But you exposed me to the Ogden Edsel record and the Barnes and Barnes and and I think you were at the same time that MTV was developing. MTV kind of had this snarky novelty video section. And all of those songs, I'm positive, came from your show.
Oh, yeah. I even did a few MTV specials myself.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
Yes.
And did you, so what's happening at that point? Now you're like 10 years in, MTV started, radio still feels like it's going strong. So, you know, what's your daily life like at that point?
I spent a lot of time, as I still do, producing the show. I mean, I listen to new stuff. Whether I go out and buy records or find records. More and more today, it's stuff that comes online or sometimes in the mail. But a large part of my week is listening to new stuff and rediscovering old stuff. And then eventually kind of sets come together in my mind.
Since the show like veered more into just comedy music, did you still keep up with rock and roll and just normal pop charts?
To some extent. That occupied a little less of my time and my passions than it maybe did in the 60s. But still, yeah.
Did you know Rodney on the Rock?
Rodney Bingenheimer, yes. We were generally competing with each other, but I'd see him when I'd go out.
Here's another, here's a song about fish heads.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Eat them up, yum. I ate fish heads last night.
Oh, wow.
No, guys, why are you laughing? I'm not kidding. This isn't a joke.
Here's another female-fronted rock band I really dig.
It's always female-fronted rock bands with Rodney.
Excellent.
I love Rodney. I worked with Rodney at K-Rock. I did the overnight show at K-Rock for a few years in the 90s.
That's right.
But by that point, you know, it was very strict playlists. You know, every time a song would come on, I didn't like, I'd try to slip in, you know, like a frog song or something. Mm-hmm. And then I would always get caught. And they're like, nope, so you got to play the playlist.
Mm-hmm.
But they let you do whatever you wanted.
Yeah. I had fortunately established myself in the ratings before the time that KMET started tightening its format.
Yeah.
And I watched them tighten their format in an incremental fashion. When I started there, they had every kind of record you can imagine. They'd even play classical music. It was pretty much what had happened at KPPC, the freeform station where the Dr. Demento show started. So the disc jockeys had this huge variety of music available. And then one night I came in to do my show, and I noticed that all the classical records were stacked out in the hall.
They've
been removed from the station and just stacked out in the corridor.
Because seriously, guys, fuck Brahms.
Yes.
Fuck him. Seriously, what's he done lately?
I think the country music was the next to go, and then most of the jazz. Kind of the last thing to go before I realized that they were just going to be rock and nothing else. Kind of the last thing to go was the Joni Mitchell kind of music.
Yeah.
And even then they would let B. Mitchell Reed play a little Joni Mitchell during his noontime show.
That's so interesting to me that there was we've almost kind of come back to that of just the idea of like playlists of, mm-hmm. you know, just like a completely disparate playlist, like a shuffle, shuffle playlist, that there was a time when radio stations kind of did that. And then they just got super focused. Like, we're only going to play this kind of rock for this specific demo. What was it like? What drove that?
It happened in stages, but it was to make it easier to sell commercials.
Okay.
KMET and other stations like it realized that the bulk of their audience was young males.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to the conclusion that if they just stuck to music that young males are known to like, that they would get a more secure hold on that audience. And by presenting themselves to commercial sponsors as somebody who had the secure hold on that audience, it would make it easier for them to sell commercials for cars and beer and other things that guys like.
Yeah.
And at the same time, top 40 music, which had at once actually been the top 40. In the 50s, a top 40 station played the 40 top-selling singles almost regardless of what kind of music they were. But that gradually changed when they realized that top 40 stations appealed most strongly to young women. You've got, nowadays, top 40 is considered an almost entirely female-leaning format.
Yeah.
So you get records that young women like.
Mm-hmm.
There was a station in Hawaii called Radio Free Hawaii, which was this guy Norm's idea of just, there was ballot boxes all across the island, and you could fill out a whole thing about what you wanted to hear. And it was all this just like the people formatted the station, and mm-hmm. it held on for a long time, but it just never made money. Like, no ads were sold, and it was just but it was a shame because it was such a, like, you can find out about so much music through this station, and it just doesn't seem like it's a way that, it's not a good business model, which is a shame.
What's the is radio as bad off now as I think it is, or is it actually still doing
worse? Probably.
Okay.
it's still making money, and there are still some very talented people in radio, But the Dr. Demento show has now migrated to cyberspace.
Sure.
DrDemento.com. Yeah, we do the show for DrDemento.com, and that's where you hear it. And we charge a small fee for listening to it, and that's how it becomes a going business for us.
Oh, good, good. So you're still able to continue to do this. Do you put out the albums every year?
We did until recently. As you probably know, the demand for CDs has been a little soft. So
right.
We haven't made a new one since 2009. I'd like to do another one. It's fun to do those things, and people seem to enjoy them. But
do you recommend playlists to people at any point?
I've been meaning to do that on iTunes. I haven't gotten around to it yet, but I've been meaning to do that.
Oh, you know what we should do is when I'm going to talk to the iTunes people and see when we put this podcast out, maybe I'll see if they'll let you like do a comedy playlist or something. That'd be really
yeah, it would be something people have told me, hey, you should work out some things like this. So yeah. Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
Who were some of the... Well, I don't know if I can make it happen. It's just something I would like to make happen. Mm-hmm. I'd also like $20 million. Yes. Can I just have that?
Yeah.
But there's probably a better chance I can help you with the iTunes thing. But who are some of the artists that you're seeing in the 70s that broke? And was there... You know, were you able to help some of them cross over to mainstream? And what were some of those examples?
Well, definitely Weird Al Yankovic.
Well, of course, yeah. Yes. But not until... That was early 80s, right? Late 70s, early 80s.
Yes. There were others who would have hits that I definitely started. One of them was Junk Food Junkie.
I remember that.
Yeah, okay.
Larry Gross.
So that crossed over and became a hit single.
Yeah.
Another one that I pretty much started was Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer by Elmo and Patsy.
Elmo and Patsy, right. I remember it. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So as far as bankable mainstream success, no, the Dr. Demento show kind of remains a thing for music geeks, nerds. And
how did Weird Al fall into, like, how did you find him?
He found me, basically. But then I picked him out of the teeming crowd and elevated. I realized that he had unique talents. He had more going for him than most of the other people who would send me cheap cassettes.
Like Dan Pasternak?
Did you ever send in a cassette?
I did.
What? You did?
Yeah.
Do you still have it?
Sure. I mean, you know what the funny thing
is? We have got to play it on this episode.
He made a record. He made a 7-inch EP.
You've got to let us play something from that on this show later.
Absolutely not.
That is bullshit. You've got to let us play something.
It's an EP with a blue label.
Oh, really?
No, I did two records. I did one in 1980 when I was 11.
Oh, my God.
And then the follow-up in 82, where actually one side, and this, I don't know if this has ever been repeated, one side played at 33 and a third, and the other side played at 45.
I thought about doing that as well.
Yeah. I did that in 1982, my friend.
Oh, my gosh. You've got to give us one track to play at the end of the show.
No, there was one song that... the Good Doctor was kind enough to play and then got onto the top 10, I don't know, like 5 or 6 times over the course of a year or so. You know, it was probably just the appeal of it was an 11-year-old kid almost saying dirty words.
Yeah.
I don't know that it was...
quite clever, as I recall.
Yeah, I don't know that it was terribly artful. Yeah, definitely inspired by Shaving Cream.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the thing is that... You know, at that age, all I was doing was absorbing everything that the doctor was putting out and then, appropriating it and, you know, squeaking it out at my...
You should repress them in mono.
That'd be amazing. For me, it's, getting to be pals with guys like you and Weird Al, like, it's so mind-melty to me because you were such a huge part of... I mean, you know, as a young kid, before the goddamn internet came along, you really had to... It was really hard to find that kind of stuff if you were a comedy nerd. It was very hard. You really... It was like a quest, which in and of itself was rewarding because you could unearth, like, oh, no one else is going to see this. You know, so my world consisted of, like, Mad Magazine and the Dr. Demento show and then whatever, you know, Al TV when they would play it.
Well, that certainly helped my show. This stuff was rare.
Yeah.
No, I got so into this that, okay, so I still have brown notebooks where I would transcribe every song that was on every Dr. Demento show from, I think, 1978 to 1982, something like that, like center cut of my youth. And literally my goal was for every song that, like, made it into the top 10 or certainly the funny 50 at the end of the year, I would seek out. I would go to record stores, Moby Disc, you know, Rhino, the original Rhino on Westwood Boulevard.
Right. Tower, Aarons.
Of course, Tower, Aarons. Yeah, Go Boy Records in the South Bay.
Penny Lane.
Yeah, all of these places. And then what I would do is I would draw a circle around the ones that I was able to purchase that were on the Dr. Demento Top 10 because they all... And by the way, I didn't need to buy them because I still have boxes of cassette recordings of all of the Dr. Demento shows that I, you know, collected through all those years. So I had them all on tape, but I had to have the records.
I did a similar thing where when the 20th anniversary double disc CD compilation mm-hmm. came out that you put out, that was when I came into awareness. I tried to get a record from each of the people, each of the artists on the compilation. I was like, all right, I got to find Stan Freber. Okay, I got to find, you know, it was just every single one I had to buy. And there was a lot that just I couldn't find.
Were you friends with all these guys?
Most of them. Of course, I did play things that never came out commercially at all, or had come out commercially only on 78s 20, 30 years earlier. But yes, to answer your other question, I was fortunate to get to know a good many people, the younger artists, and also Stan Freberg, Tom
Lehrer.
Yes.
Tell me about Tom Lehrer.
Well, he was, if you had asked him back in the 60s to state his occupation, he would say instructor in mathematics at Harvard or MIT, University of California, Santa Cruz, wherever he happened to be at the time. He was just incidentally, except for a couple of years, just incidentally a singer. I don't think he ever liked performing very much, but he realized that he had a gift for writing wonderful satiric songs, and when he was inspired, he'd do that, made these records, sold them. He was really the most successful do-it-yourself artist of any kind in the 1950s.
Oh, yeah. He was basically pressing his own records.
Right.
And, I mean, he'd go in and record. I know. I'd heard that he would go in and just in a three-hour session just record all the songs and press a record and be done. And his piano skills are insane.
Yeah.
And his diction, there is not everything that Tom Lehrer says, there's not one wasted syllable. Everything is exactly as it should be. And I've always wanted to.
And the precision of the lyrics, I mean, it was great musicality, but also the internal rhymes and I mean, it was just such literate satire.
Well, as you grew up on Tom Lehrer, he grew up with Gilbert and Sullivan.
Sure.
And Danny Kaye. That
sure.
was his other big inspiration.
Yeah, he would do a lot. He would do these, like, these. If Gilbert and Sullivan played, you know, this by, you know, and then
right.
he would go into the playing different genres of, you know, for specific songs.
Did he ever, because he had a lot of, you know, what could be considered controversial or transgressive kind of material, you know, the Vatican rag and the old dope peddler.
Step into that small confessional.
Yes.
The guy who's got religion will tell you if your sin's original. Like, those rhymes are fucking perfect.
Yes.
Drink the wine and chew the wafer.
Yeah, oh, it's if it's not, try playing it safer. Take the wine and chew the wafer. 2, 4, 6, 8. Time to transubstantiate.
Okay, we're in another level.
We're nerding out.
Well, there are some comedians who do what they do largely through improvisation.
Yeah.
That's not Tom Lehrer.
No, he seems very
precise,
and, very measured.
Now, there have been a couple of concerts that have been just recently rediscovered and made available on YouTube, or in one case, on DVD. So you now have three or four different performances available of some of his better-known songs. And the thing, when you compare them, is not the differences, but how similar they all are.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
So why do you think
he
stopped?
They're all wonderful. He wasn't inspired anymore. I don't think. He hasn't quite stated this in public, but I think he just he was very perfectionist about his performances. And when a performance didn't go exactly right, he'd feel really down about it. And so this got to be a strain. That's my guess.
I mean, it's amazing. He was so prolific for such a brief period of time. And he's still alive.
Yeah, he is still alive.
I think he still teaches.
He just retired.
Oh, he did just retire?
About 3 years ago.
He must be, what, 80 by now?
He was born in 28, so he's 84,
Jesus.
Yeah, he still lives in Cambridge, right?
He spends half the year in Cambridge in the same house he's lived in for since the early 50s.
Wow.
Spends the other half of the year in Santa Cruz, California, where he taught for the last 15, 20 years of his teaching career.
If someone ran into him and was like, oh my God, Tom Lehrer, you're amazing. I loved everything you do. Would he be like, please don't talk to me? Or is he pretty open about it?
I think he'd be cordial.
Yeah, cordial.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Open to me, yeah.
So
I think so.
Who else did you really bond with over the years?
Well, Stan Freberg. I'm having lunch with him in a couple of weeks. So
God.
He's 86, but he remarried recently, and his
sure.
And his new younger wife has kind of invigorated him a little bit. I don't know if he's performing again, but he was.
What do you mean by performing?
Oh, he made comedy then.
Oh, sorry.
I know. You probably. Yeah, I know.
Well, he said invigorated. I didn't know what he meant.
I know. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, it was a fair question.
I'm sorry.
He told me he just got back from Comic Con, so he did something there.
Wow. Freeberg was at Comic Con? How nice is that?
That's what he told me when we made our lunch date.
And so what are you thinking about, you know, do you think the internet explosion was a good thing? You know, because obviously anyone can just make a funny song or video and distribute it, or is it sort of like, well, kind of steps on my toes a little bit?
When you were talking about how hard it was to find some of this music that I'd played, probably the only thing harder in those days in the 70s was selling it.
Mm-hmm.
Like Barnes & Barnes had the biggest hit in the history of my show. With Fish Heads.
Yeah, of course.
Along with Dead Puppies. Those two are neck and neck.
Yeah.
So Barnes & Barnes decided to press up 3,000 45s. Mm. I think they still have several hundred of them.
Oh my God. Fish Heads? Oh,
wow. Yeah, right. Because the only way that they could sell these records was by doing consignments. And one store might take 5, another store might take 10 if they were lucky. So you just have to go store by store trying to sell this stuff in the days before Amoeba or anybody like
that's,
that.
That's so, what I did with the records that I made.
So Dead Puppies, Kinko the Clown, that guy's name was Bill Frenzer?
Yes.
Bill Frenzer. I actually saw him perform at the Steve Allen Theater once, and he did Dead Puppies, and it fucking blew my mind. But what was that guy's story?
Well, he was from Omaha, and the Ogden Edsel Wahalia Blues Ensemble Mondo Bizarro Band was originally a troupe of 12 singers and comedians who would do comedy sketches in the theaters of Omaha, Nebraska, and that they had a circuit. I think they got as far as Dallas and up to the Twin Cities, but they were big stars in the local comedy world, and a couple of them also started a morning radio show. So that was their trip. They never quite went national, but they got big enough to make an LP, which included Dead Puppies.
Yep.
They even came out here to Glendale, California, where there at that time was a recording studio with a pipe organ. They booked that studio especially to do the pipe organ on Dead Puppies, which really makes that as far as an arrangement goes.
Yeah, totally.
The song it ends bigger than any song ever. The end of Dead Puppies.
Yes, it's kind of the power ballad of the Dr.
But it's not a show.
I used to ask people to wave lighters, and now, of course, they wave cell phones.
They wave their cell phones and their lighter application. But was it tough for these guys, just in terms of, because they're not really coming into the system in the normal way, particularly at a time when the record industry really did control touring and the whole system. So how did these guys make a living? Were they able to tour, or was it just sort of like, oh, they kind of got to say they got played on your radio show, but they didn't really make a living doing that?
Well, Barnes & Barnes were never much into live performance.
Right. That was Bill Mumy, too.
Yeah, right. Bill had his other career as an actor and a musician and as a comics artist, too. So, or comics writer, rather.
Yeah.
Robert Hamer, who's the other half of Barnes & Barnes, he had a gig, too, that he did. So Bill Frenzer, since Ogden Edsel more or less broke up, he's had on and off success as a comedian. He does gigs, he does corporate gigs and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
There are other people who I play on my show who have fairly prosperous careers as working comedians doing comedy clubs. Henry Phillips would be
one. Henry.
Tim Cavanaugh is another one.
Yeah.
And
you play the Paul and Storm.
Of course.
Okay, I got to ask, because I truly, this guy, at least for people in L.A., was something of a local legend, but really came to, I think, greatest prominence on your show. What was Wildman Fisher's story?
Wildman Fisher, well, there's a documentary about him called De-Railroaded, which I'm in, along with Weird Al and Barnes & Barnes and many other people who knew him. He's a paranoid schizophrenic, was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic as a teenager, was institutionalized for the first time after attacking his mother. So he was in and out of mental hospitals for most of his life.
So already funny.
But, well, I don't know if he ever thought of himself. No, he never thought of himself as a comedian. He's a singer. He's a songwriter and a singer. And he thought he was the best damn songwriter and singer on the face of the earth. He was convinced of that. He was a true outsider artist. If you've ever read Erwin Chusid's book, Songs in the Key of Z, he's the epitome of an outsider artist, somebody who is pretty well convinced that he is a great artist. The public begs to disagree, but... most of the outsider artists, at least the ones in Irwin's book, have achieved at least a small degree of fame because there are people who are connoisseurs of this kind of music. Same kind of people who collect song poem records.
Song poems. Oh, yeah. Oh, the song poems are so...
But no, but, yeah, but my name to, is Larry finish, was a huge yeah, hit
just
under
to finish with Wild Man Fisher, he wrote probably... or at least made up, he didn't necessarily write them down, probably made up 1,000 songs Jeez. In his life, of which a great many were recorded, a couple dozen of them on the first album he did with Frank Zappa. Zappa was convinced that he was great, that he was well worth a 2-record album, convinced, well, he kind of controlled everything that came out on that label, even though it was distributed by Warner Brothers. He picked the artists. He said, I want to record Wild Man Fisher. And Wild Man might have continued recording for Bizarre Records for a lot longer, except one day he got mad because he wasn't a big star after that record came out, and he, I understand, he threw a flower pot at Moon, Gail, Zappa's wife, while she was holding Moon, who was then a baby, in her arms. Ooh. Just barely missed the baby. Wow. So Zappa said, get out of my house, and refused to have anything more to do with him.
That's probably wise.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, did he ever display any of that kind of behavior when you were around him?
No, I think Barnes & Barnes could probably tell you a few stories, and if you see this film Derailroaded, which I recommend, there's more stories about him. It's a very moving, it's one of the best documentaries I ever saw. I was really proud to be in it.
Yeah, he was sort of like, if you guys remember Wesley Willis.
Of course I remember Wesley
Willis. That's exactly what I was going
to
bring up.
Yeah, he to me was like a generation before Wesley Willis. That's kind of, he was like that guy 10 years before.
And Daniel Johnston to an extent too, just as far as the paranoid schizophrenic goes, of a guy just continually like recording songs in an asylum, you know.
Yeah.
And he has a great documentary out too, The Devil and Daniel Johnston.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But Wesley Willis once, my friend put on a show for him in Reno. And at the end of the show, they go back to a house where he was going to stay. And Wesley Willis just went straight into a room and locked the door. And he's like, all right, I guess he just wants to go to bed. In the morning, a car had come and pick up Wesley. And they go into the room. And all the furniture had just been pushed up to the edges of the room. And then there was just, in the middle of the room, a pile of shit. Yeah.
Well, that was nice of him to move the furniture
out
of the way.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I think he was just being...
considerate.
He was being considerate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We all know this is going to happen, but just so you know, I'm going to politely move all your furniture out of the way and just put it in the direct center.
And he called the booking agent and he was like, hey, this happened. Like, oh, yeah. Yeah.
You could say he dung shwayed the room.
Hey,
Dan Pasternak.
Dude, write that down and put music under it. What are we doing here? Dr. Demento's right there. You got a hit.
I should close with that, shouldn't I?
Dung shui.
I'm closing with that.
Yeah, you never want the tip of the shit to aim at the door because it's bad dung shui. You always want it to curl counterclockwise.
Paint your door brown.
I feel very fortunate that I've been able to do this radio show for all these years, which is home to both Tom Lehrer and Wild Man Fisher, sometimes in the same set.
Sometimes. Did you deal with that a lot? Were there a lot of guys? I mean, because obviously, you know, when you start getting into comedy, songs are weird, you know, novelty songs. That some of them you're like, yeah, this guy might be a little on the crazy side. Did people kind of stalk you over the years?
Not that I know of. I never really felt endangered by any of my fans.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Did you...
I mean, there were some that drove me a little batty for a while, and there were some that...
Dan Pasternak.
Guilty.
How did you guys...
Well, mostly you were on the phone. And, of course, I had my helpers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you answered phones. How did you actually meet up?
Well, the way I first met the good doctor, I was, I think it was in the 6th grade, and I went to, you used to do like live broadcasts, and I went to one at Tower Records on Sunset.
Oh, yeah, right.
In 1980, and you were kind enough to put me on. I think I sang a version of the Spike Jonze song "You Wanna Buy a Bunny,"
mm-hmm.
and you were very encouraging. And I met a bunch of the people from your cast on that broadcast and stayed in touch with them. And Mike Meyer, not Mike Myers of SNL, but Mike Meyer of Meyer and Drake,
mm-hmm.
who had a number of hits on your show, like the Monster Rash and the Mr. Bill song, were kind enough to produce the first two songs that I made. And then I worked for my mom all that summer at her factory in downtown LA. She had a manufacturing company. And I made enough money to press 500 45s. And then later that year is when you first played Dan's song,
mm-hmm.
which was so I was, again, I was 11 years old.
We're so playing whatever that song is at the end of this recording, because now I've said it's going to happen and people are going to demand it. So
Chris, no one is going to demand it.
Dan, the internets are going to be clogged with requests.
This is what Dan does, though. Like, he doesn't show anyone his songs, and he even pulled off all of his stand-up appearances off of the YouTube.
No, there's actually still a couple.
You did?
There.
You told me you called up like a place, and you're like, "Can you take that down, please?"
No. There was tape that I didn't want
just
available to people. Yes, from MTV.
But. I just think if more people were comfortable masturbating on the internet, Dan, you'd be okay. You know, like everyone does it. It's not a big deal.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about now.
All right, now I'm really uncomfortable. You know what? You've got Dr. Demento here to talk to. Why do we need to focus attentions on me?
Because it's funny to watch you squirm a little bit.
All right.
Because it's adorable. Look at these cheeks. He's getting all red, you adorable son of a bitch.
But Dr. Demento is here. Our hero, Dr. Demento.
It is pretty crazy that, you know, that after all this time that you still, you know, you're still able to do what you do. How's it been going with the internet
show?
Well,
it's been doing fine. Yeah, it's we seem to sell a few more shows all the time. So, it's keeping us going, doing pretty well. Actually making more money than I did off radio for the last few years of that. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Is it a subscription model?
Yes.
But, you know, are there sponsors who want to come in and go, "Hey, we want to bring, you know, get involved?"
We spun our wheels for a while trying to emphasize that before we realized, hey, we're actually not doing too badly with the subscriptions, and people can buy one show at a time too.
Yeah.
So we haven't really tried that lately, but we may try it again sometime. I mean, it seems to make the internet work. I mean, every day the internet seems to figure out more ways to expose me to ads while I try to get the news or something like that.
Yeah.
So who was the last person you got excited about, like in the same way that, like, when you first heard, like, Weird Al's cassettes that he was sending you?
Oh, let's see. There was Logan Whitehurst and Lemon Demon, who had this... the biggest hit of the new century on my show was a Lemon Demon's song called The Ultimate Showdown of Ultimate Destiny. You might have heard that. It's
hard and firm. Oh, thank you, Dr. D.
Oh, they're up there, too. Yeah.
Hey, look, it's our buddy Matt Bennett. Hey, Matt Bennett.
Hi, how you doing?
How are you?
Hi.
This is Dr. Demento. This is Matt Bennett.
Hi, Matt Bennett. Nice
Hi, Matt.
To meet you.
All right.
Hi, it's a pleasure.
Yes.
Big fan.
Matt Bennett is a fine comedian friend of ours who's on a little television program called Victorious, mm-hmm. and who does a lot of stuff here at the theater. Have you guys never met before?
No, this is awesome.
All right. Cool.
Super cool.
Nice to meet you.
We're just talking about comedy. Give Matt Bennett a mic.
Hi.
God damn it. Katie, give him a mic. Katie, do it. Katie, faster.
So exciting.
Yeah, this is great. So Matt Bennett's like 20 years old or something. Mm-hmm. What are you, 20?
I'm 20 right now.
Jesus Christ. First of all, fuck yourself. second of all, you've been a Dr. Demento fan as well.
I've been for a very long time. I have a couple of
you.
Your records as well.
Oh, right.
All the ones with Weird Al and everything on it. But
my hat's
off
to you.
Oh, thank you. He just picked up his top hat, so that makes the joke.
It is technically off. I mean,
yeah,
it's all right.
No, it really is. It was on the table, but you know what? Now it's even cooler. But yeah, so I think that what you did was super great for everything.
Oh, thanks.
What are you working on now? Are you doing anything cool?
Well, we do the show. That's the main thing that I do. I do a new show every week for drdemento.com, and be recording another one tomorrow morning. my voice holds up. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we've made you talk a lot. Yes. How did you, so as a young kid who's never not known the internet, Matt Bennett, how did you get exposed to Matt plays hilarious songs as well. He's a musical comedy guy. Well, yeah. So maybe you can slide him some stuff there, Matt Bennett.
I would
Bennett.
Love that. Yeah.
So how did you first get exposed?
It's a weird story. I went to private school and they made us all change in this little change room when I was younger, and all the kids were talking
Catholic
about, like,
school.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. I think it was a Methodist school, so it was a little bit different. But the kids were like, oh, there's this crazy song. It's by this guy named Weird Al Yankovic. You're going to love it. I'm like, oh, what is it? And it's like, it's the Phantom Menace. Like, he just rips, you know, like, he like describes it all in one song. So then I started listening to Weird Al, and then I just started listening to everything, like Fish Heads and just anything really.
And
like
you,
Dr. Demento songs.
And you, and so you've been listening to the Dr. Demento radio show. Was this kind of an inspiration for you to pursue what you ended up doing?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it sort of all fit in. You know, it was sort of kid friendly, but also, you know, just what I liked about it was you could pretty much get away with anything in those days if you just called it. It was sort of like a parody. So, you know, you could make fun of something directly, and under the guise of a parody, it would be okay to make fun of it. And as a kid, that's like, I can make fun of anything as long as I call it a parody.
Yeah.
So I'm like, this is great. Now I found a way. So I'm like, oh no, Mom, I wasn't, you know, making fun of so-and-so. It was a parody.
Oh.
So I found like a loophole through these songs to, you know, to start comedy.
That works with the government too. Oh, no, I wasn't ripping off the song. It was a parody.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, the Two Live Crew case kind of legitimized all that.
That's right.
The Supreme Court decided that parody was fair use.
Right.
So after that, publishers had very little recourse. Even if they didn't like a parody, there wasn't very much they could do about it.
Are you talking about because they used the Me So Horny sample, or are you talking about Two Live Jews, which covered?
No.
Do you remember Two Live Jews?
Oh yes.
Yeah, Two Live Jews. Do you remember?
No.
I don't think so.
It was. I think it was. I'm. You think I'm doing a bit? I'm not. There was a parody song called like "Me So Hungry" or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was the group was called Two Live Jews, and it was like Me So Hungry. Like it was
their big hit was Oi, it's so humid. Sauna in here.
Oh yeah, yeah. Maybe it wasn't about food. I don't know. But anyway, Two Live Jews was an actual.
Yeah, I think Al cornered the market on all the food based comedy. Yeah.
Isn't that funny that I mean, it is another testament to Al is that he has been that guy, and no one, like, if anyone else does it, like, fuck you, that's Weird Al's thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's amazing that he's been able to corner that market.
More than 30 years.
More than 30 years, and he's still relevant.
Even all the fakers on, you know, LimeWire and Kazaa and Napster and stuff, all the people.
Yeah.
It all just gets labeled under Weird Al. Because,
yeah,
you know,
that's true.
Napster, you must have been.
I had Napster. Napster, I was there for the start of it.
2000.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Yeah, I know, but he's 20.
Yeah, so he's
so
like,
2000, it makes him 8 years old.
He was taking a Napster during Napster.
He was taking a Napster. Hey, wait, let's all.
Download times were so long.
Here's a really funny way to bum everyone out. You guys ready? Matt, what year were you born?
1991.
Oh, I just got diarrhea in my own stomach.
Yeah. Well,
he was born with a computer in his hand.
He really was.
Well, yeah. Game Boy, but.
Oh, I'm going to Wesley Willis this room in a minute. Here, I'm just going to move the furniture.
Just push it back.
Yeah. I move the furniture.
But think about it. So, how old are you now, Chris?
Older than you.
Older than me?
Yeah.
I know that because Jonah, you were talking about just turning 30.
Just turned 30.
So, there's 10
yeah.
years between us, and I think there's 10 years between you guys. Too.
God damn it.
So, I'm just saying that that's the same age gap, so we're all sort
well,
of connected.
No,
in this
I have a no. When I first met Jonah Ray, Jonah was your age because he worked as a writer's assistant on a pilot that we did for Showtime 10 years ago, and the producers had to send Jonah out for a bottle of prop tequila for a bit, but because he was not yet 21, Kulop, Scott Aukerman's then girlfriend, now wife, had to go with you to buy the bottle
it's
of
like
tequila.
They asked me, I was like, I'm right on it. And then I had to go, hey, can you, I need to help.
You needed an assistant for the writer's assistant.
Exactly.
Can you imagine there was a time you couldn't buy alcohol?
Oh, don't even remind me.
I mean, sorry. I know it's a problem.
I don't think that ever stopped him.
I mean,
every so often I'll play a song from the Prohibition era and have to explain what it was.
Oh, wow.
And segue into something about marijuana. And
what kind of comedy music was going on in the third? Like, what was the beginning of comedy music, like as contemporary comedy music as we know it?
Oh, as we know it. Well, you might say it started with the beginning of records. That was the first time that a performance could be commercialized, and there were comedy songs from pretty much the beginning of records. A lot of politically incorrect comedy songs
of course,
in the older days, because it was very popular to make fun of other races or other or other ethnic groups.
Yeah,
still is in Hawaii. Still yes. Very popular in Hawaii.
So there was a lot of that. Comedy as we know it, well, Spike Jones was a big step in that direction.
Yeah.
Who became hugely popular during and after World War II and made records that were huge hits and put a lot of effort into making each one perfect.
Yeah.
Had a great stage show, too, with a cast of 50.
Oh, my Whoa. God.
And then after that, we get the generation of Stan Freberg and Tom Lehrer.
Yeah.
Very different artists, but definitely contemporaries, appealing to a lot of the same people. Then we segue into the era of novelty rock and roll music with the Purple People Eater, and They're Coming to Take Me Away, et cetera. And,
Goodman and Buchanan, all the cut-in records.
Yeah, the Flying Saucer records, 56. And then the era of stand-up comedy begins in the 50s and really catches fire in the early 60s with Bob Newhart. Shelley Berman et al. And so you're getting a quick history of comedy then. Parody has always been around. Homer and Jethro did a lot of that in the 1950s. They would have to ask permission from everybody, but they did it. And then you get Weird Al kind of, Alan Sherman before that in the early 60s.
He did
a ton of parodies. Mostly parodies of public domain stuff, classical music and folk songs.
Oh, that's right.
Until he got big enough so that people would listen to him. Like, the first really extended parody concept he did was an album based on My Fair Lady, and the publishers turned him down. They wouldn't let him put it out. So Warner Brothers Records, which wanted to sign him, said, well, why don't you do an album of folk songs? So he did, and the rest is history.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. That's pretty funny. Just like, I love the idea of someone running around like, I want to do a parody of My Fair Lady. What?
That's what he did. He wrote a complete full-length thing, a parody of every song.
Did it ever get put out?
Yes, much later, on a box set that Rhino Handmade put out.
What was it called?
It was a kind of a Yiddish takeoff on the title.
Oh, is this My Fairfax Lady?
No, that was different.
No, because there was a thing called My Fairfax Lady.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mickey Katz, I think, did that.
Oh, okay. But that wasn't...
Alan Sherman's was different. I've got my first mental block of the day on the name.
Yeah, I think you're doing all right. Yeah. But where do you put groups like Firesign Theater? You know, like, is this more sketch? Just more. I miss like good. That's why I love Thrilling Adventure Hour so much. It's just like good radio friendly sketch comedy.
Yeah, well, Firesign Theater, their inspiration was radio from the days of drama on radio, the Dragnet and Green Hornet era.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of adapted that for a hipper generation.
Yeah.
Perhaps a chemically altered generation that had something to do with it, and also took advantage very, very skillfully of recording technology, layering all these things. So there'd be three or four different things going at once, which is something that Cheech and Chong also got from them.
Yeah. Did you ever see the Funny or Die video, Weird? Did you see the Weird Al?
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Right. Yes.
Yeah, Oswald played it.
Yeah, right. I was flattered by that.
Because Frank Zappa, who you played a lot of his songs, but he was also just a serious musician putting out non-comedic songs.
Right.
Did you come into awareness of him through his funny songs, or were you already a fan of his normal stuff?
Well, I was told that I ought to go see Frank Zappa at the Whiskey. That's the first time I saw him.
Wow.
And he was doing funny and serious stuff together, mixing them as he did on most of his albums. I still kind of think the funny music was something that he did to draw in an audience.
Really?
Especially young men. He realized that a lot of the music he wrote might be a hard sell as far as getting younger people who were not from the classical community to listen to it. But if he wrote a song about yellow snow or a song about titties and beer, he realized that he could probably get a lot of impressionable young men and young women, too, to come in and listen to his stuff. And while they were waiting for Don't Eat the Yellow Snow, they get exposed to a bunch of challenging,
yes,
brilliant music.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you listen to like the long version of Don't Eat the Yellow Snow, that's no slouch either. There's a lot going on that piece.
Yeah, there was even, I think, on a Weird Al record, he did a, I can't remember what at record or what song.
Genius in France.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. And that was like very much a...
Which is a song about Jerry Lewis, but the music is all his subtle spoof of Zappa.
Yeah, exactly. That's great.
I was wondering how you feel about the Marx Brothers and their place, because they sort of, in my opinion, they brought a lot of, you know, comedy songs into movies.
When I first started the show, they were some of the first older stuff that I played. I had an LP of Groucho singing songs from his movies, and Hooray for Captain Spaulding from that album was very popular on my show. And so that, along with Spike Jones, was kind of, I think, my audience's introduction to older stuff.
Yeah.
In the early days of the Dr. Demento show. And, of course, I still go back to that now and then.
Was, do you know Harvey Sid Fisher?
Oh, yes.
Was he serious or was that not serious? Do you know Harvey Sid Fisher?
Mm-mm.
Harvey Sid Fisher sang a different song for every sign of the zodiac.
Right.
And you're listening to it, you're going, this is either the least ironic thing I've ever heard or the most ironic thing I've ever heard. But each sign of the zodiac has its own, and it's kind of 70s-ish, and, you know, it's like the song about Taurus is like, bully bull bull, I'm a bull bull. Like, he sings the literal, like, what their attributes are and what the animal, like,
how
what
do
the,
I not know that?
I don't know how you don't know Harvey Sid Fisher.
Is that where your horoscope for the day, the Weird Al song, came from?
I don't know, maybe.
I'm sure Al was aware of it.
I'm sure he must have been, yeah. Who else did you, was there ever one that you were like, man, this is amazing, and for whatever reason, it just never caught on?
Mm.
No.
Yeah, there's some.
Dance song?
No, that, that found an audience.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It found about the audience it was supposed to have.
What'd you do with all those 45s? Did you sell them?
I actually sold, for the first one, yeah, I actually sold them.
That's fucking great. That's like, we sold 500 copies of that?
Yeah, I mean, but again, it was like what the good doctor was saying. It's like you take two or three to different record stores, and, you know, they're on consignment. And I have to say that the Dr. Demento show was powerful enough that, like, look, every kid my age was obsessed with the Dr. Demento show. And it certainly, you know, was a big deal for me, you know, as a sixth grader, as a seventh grader, because everybody listened to the show. So I was able to sell enough of them that I saved up the money and was able to press another record, which didn't sell at all.
I'm curious, because now that Matt Bennett has joined, being the youngest member on the age totem pole, what are challenges for you now with music, and what's really easy about what you do and what's really hard about what you're doing now?
I guess that's a good question. I don't know. It's actually, the position that I'm in sort of makes it easy to do this. I sort of write songs that are, you know, border on being, I don't want to say they're straight up comedy songs, but they are funny. Or at least I like to say they're written with, you know, sort of cleverness in mind. But I also do a Nickelodeon show, so I sort of have this audience.
This built-in audience.
Yeah, this audience that it's pretty appropriate for.
Yeah.
So it's sort of easy for me, but, you know, I see a lot more people sort of doing this, you know, with the internet and everything. I mean, there's Bo Burnham, of course.
Sure.
Sort of, you know, and I don't know if you guys know George Watsky.
I don't know George Watsky.
He put up a video that got like millions upon millions of views, where it's just him rapping really fast, but really clever stuff as well.
And there's that kid, Luke Scott.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Very popular on my show.
Really funny. Yeah, like great. Really great stuff.
Really good stuff, yeah.
Does a good live show, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He did the Bringing Skeksis Back song,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, when he heard us talking about that, Bringing Skeksis Back.
He did the Skeksis video.
Then another branch of what I do, there are a good many artists who do funny songs and serious songs, and ones that are kind of a little of both. Randy Newman would be one.
Sure, yeah.
Christine Lavin, more recently.
I don't know.
Whatever happened with Tom T-Bone Stankus, who had probably one of my favorite songs?
The Existential Blues.
The Existential Blues.
That song was one of my favorite songs.
It's a mind-blower.
It's so good.
And he did that live when you did your 10th anniversary show at Wolf and Rissmiller's Country Club in 81.
Yes.
He came out and did that live. And I remember that blew my mind. And I just thought, this guy is a genius.
He's still alive and well, doing fine, but he's morphed into being a children's entertainer.
Oh, wow.
Part of he got religion and kind of decided maybe I shouldn't do the existential blues all my life, though I think he'll still sing it when the audience is right. But he's really a kid's entertainer. That's what he
does. So no more songs about poppies.
have you played any of Tom Wilson's stuff?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, Tom Wilson's great. His homonym song.
Have you heard Tom Wilson's homonym song? Have you heard Tom Wilson's?
No.
Do yourself a favor. Tom Wilson.
Is he?
He's Biff from.
Yes,
Biff, that's what I thought.
Yes. But
I heard that one song.
And he used to perform with a tuba.
Yeah, that's an older song. He has a new song that's called just all homonyms, and it's just it's really trippy. It's really good.
Awesome.
So drdemento.com, people can go and subscribe, and they should. Is there anything else you want to plug while you're here, or anything else you want to tell people before we release you?
Oh, there's a graphic novel called Earthworld, done by Robert Balder, and he is going to be doing an audio version of that, I think, with the limited animation too online. Okay. And I've been cast as Lord Stanley in the audio version of Earthworld, which will start production soon.
So people do subscribe to your show. Is there a donations button too? Can people donate to the show to keep it going?
No, we just do it by it's $2 per single show or $14.95 for a subscription.
Yeah,
which means that you can also plunder our library of 700 plus older shows, going all the way back to some of the first shows I did as Dr. Demento in 1970.
Wow.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing. I mean, it really I think you were one of the forefathers of what we kind of think of as the modern podcast, in the sense that, you know, you're a guy with a very specific field of knowledge and you love what you do and you expose people to this world. And that's kind of that's the ultimate philosophy of what we do here. But I don't know if it ever would have occurred to me that radio or even podcasting would be a fun thing that I could actually do if it hadn't been for you.
Well, thanks. You know, if the radio show hadn't kind of fallen into my lap, if I hadn't come along at just the moment when freeform radio was open to concepts like this, I probably would have been a professor somewhere.
Oh really?
Or a teacher of some kind.
In Portland?
Maybe in Portland. That's where I went to undergraduate school at Reed.
Yeah.
Though my presence here is due to UCLA. UCLA had a master's program in folk music studies for a few years in the 1960s. Folk music was my passion, especially blues in the 60s. And so I came here, became one of their first students, got a master's degree in folk music studies.
Wow.
To hang on
my
wall. Yes. But I wrote my thesis about the early days of rock and roll and the folk roots of rhythm and blues.
Wow. That's fantastic.
Yes. You should put that on your blog.
I was also a next-door neighbor and really good friend for a while of John Fahey, who's now the late John Fahey has become more and more esteemed after his passing as one of the pioneers of contemporary guitar.
Wow. Oh, wow.
So we were good friends.
So it sounds like there's a house open next
Drinking
to you, so
buddies,
we should just we should just buy it and move in next door.
Well, that was in Venice back in the 60s.
Oh, okay. That was a long time
ago.
Cheaper,
yes. A little cheaper back then.
Yeah, John passed away in 2001, but after a colorful life.
They've been releasing a lot of his music now.
Yes.
They've been doing a lot of box
just sessions. About everything that he did is now available again.
If people want to submit songs to you, what can they do?
DrDemento.com.
Yep.
DrDemento@drdemento.com is my email address, DrDemento. Mm-hmm. Or you can do it the good old-fashioned way with a CD, or even once in a while get a cassette, and we always accept vinyl, and that's P.O. Box 884, Culver City, California, 90232.
Now, if there's any way, we usually sign off the end of our shows telling people enjoy your burrito. Would you mind giving us like a classic Dr. Demento send off, like the end of the show, and then just tell people to enjoy their burrito?
Don't forget to stay demented and enjoy your burrito.
Yay! Dr. Demento, thank you for letting us nerd out on you for this hour.
Well, thank you, Chris. You know, the word nerd, which was invented, I think, when you were a very small tot, if not earlier, you have managed to co-opt very nicely.
Oh, thank you. I think I believe the etymology of the word is Seussian in nature. I think it actually goes back to an old Dr. Seuss story.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, let me push up my imaginary glasses. At the moment. Geek, of course, is from the German word geck, which were sideshow freaks who would bite the heads off snakes and chickens.
And dork is a whale's penis.
It's true.
It's true. Yeah.
So there you go. And Matt Bennett, thank you for being our surprise guest. It's good to see you. What are you doing? What are you doing here?
The show. We got a show downstairs.
Oh, shit, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's at 8.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you, Matt. Send me something.
Absolutely. Yes, I will absolutely do that. No question.
I'll connect to you guys. And Dan Pasternak, thank you for being here.
Oh, my God. Thank you. Thank you for letting me crash.
Of course, buddy. Oh, we love you. Guy, I'm going to get that song from you. Let me scratch you behind the ear.
Oh, that feels good.
All right, good.
Dan threw a can into a fan, and he said, oh, darn. Mike couldn't ride a bike, so we gave him a trike that we knew he'd like. Kit lost his mitt, he had a fit, and he said, oh, shoot. Chuck was driving a truck when he hit a duck, and he said, oh, heck. Joe, don't you know that you shouldn't go to the Alamo. Nell stole a bell, and you just can't tell if she goes to heaven, who knows. Rich dug a ditch, he threw a pitch, you son of a gun. Rick learned a trick, he thought it was slick, but actually he's a pretty good magician. Lou went to the zoo, and he caught the flu from a kangaroo. Oh, and by the way, if any of you are offended by this song, well, stick it up your...
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest. And they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.